Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Amos Oz has gained international fame for writing about normal lives, often obscure, ordinary lives, in his native Israel. Looming over it all, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, is the tortured relationship between Israel and its neighbors, even when it seems like Oz is trying hard not to write about the situation. He's out now with a collection of stories of life in one fictional Israeli village, and there, too, the present can't quite bury the past. There's a sound of digging in the night. It's a little bit Edgar Allan Poe, a little bit Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a little Chekhov, and all Oz. This hour on Point, Amos Oz and Scenes from Village Life. You can join the conversation. Do you follow Amos Oz? Do you recognize the characters in his books in your world? Their issues in the headlines out of Israel. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Amos Oz, Amos Oz to his countrymen, novelist and journalist, a professor of literature at Ben-Gurion University, author of A Tale of Love and Darkness, A Panther in the Basement, and the 1995 collection of essays Israel, Palestine, and Peace. His latest book, just out in the U.S., is called Scenes from Village Life, translated from Hebrew by Nicholas DeLange. Amos Oz, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We want to dive into your village. I look forward to doing that. I want to ask you just about a couple things in the news first, because it's just coming out today that UNESCO, the UN organization in Paris, has defied this a mandate of American funding and has approved a Palestinian bid for full membership there. The vote today, 107-14, 52 abstentions, cheering in the hall as that happened. This after, of course, the Palestinians went to the UN looking for full membership and recognition there. What crosses your mind when you see this kind of UNESCO or world response to the Palestinians' effort, Amos Oz?
Well, I've been struggling for a two-state solution and an historical compromise between Israel and Palestine for more than 40 years now. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, if the Palestinians want to declare an independent state, let them give Israel a 48 advance notice so that for historical reasons, Israel can be the first nation to recognize Palestine. And then we can go on disagreeing and negotiating and bargaining about boundaries and settlements and holy places and so on.
That's what you'd like to see, 48 hours to give Israel a heads up and Israel to be the first to congratulate it on this or to accept it anyway. But that's not the way it's gone. Why not?
Well, there are extremists on both sides, both on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side. And there is the Israeli government who prefers to first settle the unresolved issues and then accept the existence of a Palestinian state.
Do you expect, as you say, you've been writing about this for so many years as a literary writer, as a journalist, you're 70-something now. Do you expect in your lifetime to see a breakthrough on this?
That depends on how long my lifetime expectancy
well,
is.
Let's say it's a very long one. Let's say you live to be 110, and we hope so.
I won't be surprised. In the Middle East, words like never, forever, or for eternity normally mean something between 3 months and 30 years.
So maybe, if life should be long enough.
Well, I can give you some good news from the Middle East. You are all very much used to bad news from the Middle East.
Yes.
And the good news is that the majority of the Israeli Jews and the majority of the Palestinian Arabs know now that in the end of the day there will be a two-state solution. Are they happy with this knowledge? They are not. Will they be dancing in the streets in Israel and in Palestine when the two-state solution is implemented? They will not be dancing in the street, but they know it now. If I could use a simple metaphor, I would say that the patient, Israeli and Palestinian, is ready for the surgery, but the doctors are cowards.
the doctors, ends in leaders on both sides, I guess you're suggesting. Indeed. Why that? If it's cowardice, why?
Well, they're afraid of the fanatics, and I don't belittle the impact of the fanatics on both sides. They have the conventional accepted truths about the conflict. They worry about the disputed issues, and there are some disputed issues and unresolved issues. But deep down below, almost everyone knows what the solution is.
What does it take to make that actually happen? I mean, we've seen what's happened with Israeli politics in recent years. They've become more conservative. We've seen Hamas very solid on the Palestinian side. It doesn't look as though it's ready to really change its stripes. What does it take?
It takes courage. Over 30 years ago, President Sadat of Egypt traveled to Jerusalem in a dramatic breakthrough and recognized Israel. And in return, the right wing and extremist Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin gave back to Egypt the whole of Sinai in return for a peace document. So it had happened before, and it may happen again.
Take us in. We'll talk more about the situation there. There's so much that's been going on lately with Gilad Shalit and settlements and a lot. But you're also taking us to a very human level in this collection of stories. And I wonder if you'd read just a bit for us about your fictional village of Tel Ilan, MSS. Could you read a little description for us?
Tel Ilan, a pioneer village already century old, was surrounded by fields and orchards. Vineyards sprawled down to the east-facing slopes. Almond trees lined the approach road, tile roofs bathed in the thick greenery and ancient trees. Many of the inhabitants still farmed, with the help of foreign laborers who lived in huts and farmyards. But some had leased out their land and made a living by letting rooms, by running art galleries or fashion boutiques, or by working outside the village. Two gourmet restaurants had opened in the middle of the village, and there was also a winery and a shop selling tropical fish. One local entrepreneur had started manufacturing reproduction antique furniture. On weekends, of course, the village filled with visitors who came to eat or to hunt for a bargain. But every Friday afternoon, its streets emptied as the residents rested behind closed shutters.
Amos Oz, reading from Scenes from Village Life, a little description there of his Israeli fictional village, Tel Ilan. What matters to you about the life in this village, Amos Oz?
Well, this book was born out of a dream. Several years ago, I dreamt that I was in one of those old Jewish villages. There are about 20 such villages in Israel. And I say old, I mean at least twice as old as the state of Israel. And I was in one of those villages in my dream, and I was looking for someone, and the village was abandoned, empty. Not a dog, not a cat, not a bird. And in the middle of the dream, as it happens in the middle of dreams, it was no longer me looking for someone, but some people looking for me and me trying to hide or run away. When I woke up, I knew that my next book was going to be located in such an old village. And these are interwoven stories. Mm-hmm. It's really a novel in stories because the characters move from one story to the next. They all know each other. They meet in one story and they meet in another story and they meet again in a third story.
I won't ask you to understand all the meaning of your own dreams. Who could? But your old Jewish village was abandoned. Why, do you think?
Well, I would rather not give it allegorical significance. This is not a book about the state of Israel and not about Middle East politics and not about the world of the CNN. This is more about human condition than about the Israeli condition. It's about love and love and loss and loneliness and longing. It's about death and desire and desolation and disillusionment. It's about the great and simple things.
I've heard you say that, and I've read it, and I see all those things there, no question about it. It's hard to, though, not see Israel's overall circumstances in the weave of what you've written. But you take it very, very local. There's no question about that. And I've seen you give credit to Sherwood Anderson in Winesburg, Ohio, his book about small-town life in the United States, of all things. Why was that book important to you, Amos Oz?
When I was 16 and hoping to become a writer, I felt I was trapped in a catch-22 situation. I thought at the age of 16 that in order to become a famous writer, I have to first live in a big city like New York or London or Paris. But in order to afford to live in a big city, I have to be a famous writer first. So it was a catch-22 situation. And then I read the Hebrew translation of Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio. Mm. And he taught me that for a writer, the place where you are is the center of the universe. This is anti-Copernicus, the opposite of Copernicus. Mm-hmm. The center of the universe is right where the writer is. And this liberated my writing hand and set me going.
Did you identify with the characters in Winesburg, Ohio? That's a long way from your kind of youth in Israel and time in the kibbutz and the rest.
Yes, but they were small-time people, and I write about small-time people, unhappy small-time people. If you ask me to tell you in one word what all my 27 books are about, I will say families. If you gave me two words, I'll say unhappy families. If you gave me three words, you'll have to read my books.
Each unhappy in their own way, no doubt. Why unhappiness as your second word?
Well, unhappiness for a storyteller is a lot more fascinating than happiness. Happiness speaks for itself and is self-explicit. Unhappiness is unique in each family. Each family is unhappy in its own way, as Tolstoy put it. And I write about unhappy families because I'm fascinated by the suffering people bring upon each other, by the suffering people bring upon themselves, by the endless tragicomedy of human suffering, which is very often self-inflicted and self-imposed.
Do you think the happiness quotient is different in different cultures or countries? Or are all humans more or less equally happy or unhappy? We see the surveys, but as a literary man, thinker, how do you see it?
Well, you know, in Hebrew, we don't even have a proper word for happiness. The Hebrew word osher, which is normally translates as happiness, means positive feedback from others. There are six Hebrew words for joy because there are many kinds of joy, whereas happiness is an abstraction. An everlasting happiness is a non-existent experience. I believe in passing joys, in coming joys which come and go and disappear. I don't believe in everlasting happiness, in arriving there, leaning back and enjoying yourself forever.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with Israeli novelist and journalist Amos Oz about his new collection of stories, Scenes from Village Life. He joins us today from Washington. Amos Oz, let's begin to talk with our village. Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Amos Oz.
Hi, it's an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, Mr. Oz. I read one of your books and a lot of other stuff by you. You mentioned the courage of Israelis in making a peace treaty happen, and Palestinians. I'm a Jew, and I have a lot of family in Israel, and I care a lot about it. I'm always interested in what Israelis would think we should do, and specifically, I put it this way: if you could think what it might mean for a Jew in the diaspora to be courageous on behalf of Israel.
In other words, when you say what we should do, you mean Jews not in Israel, but outside Israel.
Correct.
What would courage be there? Amos Oz?
Yes, well, you ask me what Israelis think, and I'll tell you that there are no two Israelis ever in agreement on anything. It's hard to get one Israeli to agree with himself or herself because everybody has a divided mind and soul. But on the whole, Israel is divided over the issue of war and peace. It's divided right in the middle. I believe we should make an historical compromise with the Palestinians, and I believe it can be done, taking certain risks. Now, non-Israeli Jews, diaspora Jews, should reassure and encourage Israel that if it is indeed going to take the risks for peace, America will be firmly behind Israel and reassure Israel and strengthen it when it takes the necessary risks.
So, for Jews in the diaspora, you're asking for courage from Israeli leaders and Palestinian leaders. I mean, Jews in the American diaspora already quite heavily support that position, that the U.S. would be behind Israel. Is there something more that would comprise courage for that community in your view?
Well, I think I would like American Jews to support the peace camp in Israel. It's a controversial bid, but I think they should support the more pragmatic Israel and the more compromising Israel and the more peace-oriented Israel.
Why is that not the Israeli majority at the moment?
Because the Israelis are afraid, and they have legitimate fears, and they have serious reasons for apprehension. Peace and releasing the occupied territories, giving back the occupied territories, will contain a serious risk for Israel, taking a serious risk. And the Israelis have their reasons to be afraid of those risks.
So would that support for peace, would that mean a change in the American, in the weight of American Jewish opinion or influence on the Israel issues?
By and large, American Jews think they always have to stand behind the Israeli government. I am saying there is more than one way to be pro-Israel, there is more than one way to support Israel, and there is more than one way to identify with Israel.
I appreciate your call, Michael, there from Beaufort. Let's get another from Mallory in Storrs, Connecticut. Mallory, you're on the air with Amos Oz.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. So I would like to ask of our author here today, American people don't get a very intimate or diverse view of the lives of Israeli people and Palestinian people and, you know, people throughout the whole Middle East. It tends to be very centralized on war and politics. And so what I would like to ask the author, what would he like Americans to know about the people of Israel and the people of Palestine in their daily lives?
Read our literature. Read the Palestinian literature. Read the Arab literature. The best way to get to know a people inside us, out, not just in the shallow CNN projection, but to know the intimate life of a people, is to read the literature. The literature takes you into the living room and into the nursery and even into the bedrooms of other peoples. So the best way of traveling, really, universally, I'm not only talking about Israelis and Palestinians, but universally, the best way of traveling is to read other people's literature, to read foreign literatures. And if you want to know more about Israelis and Palestinians, my best advice is read the two literatures.
We're going to do that right here in just a moment. And from your latest, but take it just a step further, if you would, Amos, because we don't get you here every day. I mean, if, let's say Mallory does that, give her a hint of what she's likely to learn about Israelis, about Palestinians that she may not know from those headlines.
She's likely to learn that whereas in the world of the CNN, 80% of the Israelis are religious fanatics or fanatic settlers on the West Bank, 19% are ruthless soldiers in the roadblocks, and 1% are wonderful intellectuals like myself who criticize the government and struggle for peace, the real Israeli is 70 or 80% secular to the bone, hedonistic, noisy, passionate, warm-hearted, materialistic, talkative, pushy, a very Mediterranean people. In short, we Israelis belong in a Fellini movie and not in an Ingmar Bergman film.
Give us the benefit of your perspective, similar perspective on the Palestinians and what we don't know from headlines.
I'm less of an expert on Palestinians, but I will tell you that the majority of the Palestinians are not fanatics. They are a people of workers and peasants who have been living under foreign occupation, under Israeli occupation, for four decades and more, and they crave for freedom and crave for independence and crave for sovereignty. They have their share of fanatics, religious fanatics, but the majority of the Palestinians are not, contrary to the image projected in the media.
Mallory, I appreciate your call and your question. Amos Oz, I wish you'd read a bit more for us from Scenes from Village Life. The biggest, longest story, anyway, in the book is called Digging. And there's a scene here. Maybe you can introduce us to the characters. There's a father, a daughter, and they have a boarder here. Could tell us a little bit about them, and then maybe we can get to Van Gogh's straw hat.
There is a widow of 50, a good-looking woman, Rachel. Mm-hmm. There is her old father, 86-year-old, who is a former member of the Knesset and a very grumpy man. And there is an Arab lodger who works in the farm or helps them with the house calls, but at the same time he is busy writing or aspiring to write a book comparing life in the Arab village to life in the Jewish village.
And this Arab lodger's name is Adele.
Adele walked around the yard wearing a Van Gogh straw hat and an expression of wonderment and longing. His shoulders were always covered with the powdering of dandruff. He had an absent-minded way of smoking. He would light a cigarette, drawn it three or four times, sucking his cheeks right in, then put it down on the fence or on the windowsill, forget to lit the lit cigarette and light another one. A reserve cigarette was always tucked behind his ear. He smoked a lot, but with an air of disgust, as if he hated the smoke and the smell of tobacco, as if it were someone else who was smoking and puffing the smoke in his face. He also developed a very special relationship with Rachel Katz. He had long, respectful conversations with them in Arabic, and in a low voice, as though letting them in on a secret. Former member of Knesset Pesach Kedem did not like the student. "You can see right away," the old man said, "that he hates us but hides his hatred under a layer of sycophancy. They all hate us. How could they not? If I were them, I'd hate us too. In fact, I'd hate us even without being them. Take it from me, Rachel. If you just look at us, you can see that we deserve nothing but hatred and contempt, and maybe a bit of pity. But the pity cannot come from the Arabs. They themselves need all the pity in the world."
That is a complicated paragraph, but goes very deep. MSR's reading there from the story Digging in his book Scenes from Village Life. And he's both grumpy, very irascible, but at the same time, there's a kind of empathy toward Arabs who need pity as well.
Well, in another place in the story, Adele says that both the Jews and the Arabs are unhappy, but for different reasons, and he dwells on the reasons. The grumpy old man says that if both Jews and Arabs are unhappy, why sit here and write a comparison? What is there to compare?
What is there to compare? Well, maybe plenty. Laurie in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Laurie, you're on with Amos Oz.
Oh, this is wonderful to hear and be able to talk to Amos Oz. I wondered your thoughts, sir, on the continuous expansion of the settlements in Israel and what can be done, because it seems that it is going to prevent any possibility of a two-state solution. And a quick second question, many of your thoughts that I've heard expressed so far are so similar to an organization here in this country called J Street, which is the political home for pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans.
Well, to answer the two questions briefly, settlements. I have been opposed to building Jewish settlements in the occupied territories right from the way go, from the word go, right from 1967. I think the settlements are an obstacle to peace, but not a deadly obstacle. Finally, when the two-state solution materializes, some of those settlements will have to be evacuated. Others will be incorporated into Israel in a way of swapping land between Israel and Palestine. And still others may learn to live under Palestinian sovereignty, but not as masters. As for J Street, an organization working for peace between Israelis and Palestinians while being sympathetic to Israel and pro-Israel, I endorse it, support it, and identify with it.
And we'll take it right there. Let me get one more, if I may, Amos. Nina in Brighton, Massachusetts. Nina, you're on the air.
Hi, my name's Nina. I'm an observant Jew, and perhaps the author would actually consider me a religious fanatic for that reason. I was born in Israel, and I was raised in the U.S., and I think the majority of Israeli Jews and American Jews would love to see peace, but the reality on the ground is that you have Islamic jihadists who are being funded by Iran to kill and destroy and want the annihilation of the Jewish people, and giving land will not create peace with them. You also have a historical background and context in which we gave away the Gush Katif. It did not bring peace. It just brought rockets closer to the Jewish people and to the Israeli people. And I want to know what the author thinks this leap of faith would accomplish.
Nina, stick with us for a second. Amos Oz?
Yes, the Islamic Jihad and the Hamas and the fanatic organizations are a fact of life. Fortunately, the majority of the Palestinian people does not identify with those fanatics. We have our share of Israeli fanatics as well. But I believe it is crucial to overrule the fanatics and despite the fanatics, to make peace. And I think peace is possible because there is fatigue and exhaustion on both sides. And I'm a great believer in fatigue and exhaustion. Most human conflicts, not only international conflicts, but even individual conflicts, don't solve through a magic formula. They die down through fatigue and exhaustion. And finally, I see syndromes of blessed fatigue and exhaustion both on the Israeli side and on the Palestinian sides. Not on the side of the fanatics, they never tire. But the majority is tired and ready for a sad compromise. And compromises are sad by definition. There is no such thing as a happy compromise.
Nina, what do you say to that perspective?
I can't disagree more. I don't see any fatigue or exhaustion after an exchange of 1,000 terrorists for one Israeli-Jewish, Gilad Shalit. And right away, we have rockets again being pounded down. I don't see exhaustion when there is endless funding coming in from Iran. I just don't think that this is realistic, what you're proposing. I think that we all want peace. Peace is great. And I do believe that the majority of Palestinians want peace. But you know what? Even if only it's 2%, 3%, there are a lot of Islamic jihadists out there. There's a huge Arab population, and we're surrounded by enemies in Israel. So to say that it's only 2 or 3%, how many thousands of people is that that are willing to blow themselves up with endless funding?
Amos?
Yes, we are surrounded by enemies, but peace is something you make with an enemy. You don't make peace with a friend. And animosity will die down after, not before, we make peace. It will be unrealistic to expect the Arabs and the Israelis to first undergo a change of heart and then make peace. Throughout history, it works the other way around. First, sign peace with clenched teeth and perhaps malintentions. And then, after the signing of a formal peace treaty, the hatred may gradually die down. We have signed peace with Egypt, and it's hold. It's not a love affair, but it's a peace, and it's holding. We had signed a peace with Jordan, and it's holding. It's not a love affair again, but it's holding. If we sign a peace with the Palestinians, it will hold. Now, let us not confuse peace with love. The old slogan of the peaceniks in the 1960s ran, make love, not war. My slogan vis-a-vis the Palestinians is make peace, not love.
Make peace, not love. And what about the urgency of the fear or distrust you hear from Nina there?
Well, I think distrust is a condition, a natural condition in times of conflict. You don't dismantle the distrust before you make peace. You make peace and then work on the distrust.
In your story, Digging, in Scenes from a Village, and Nina, thank you for your question. I hope this is relevant to it. Your old member of the Knesset, our grumpy old chap, Pesach, he hears digging in the night. And not only him, then their Arab border hears it. And finally, everybody in the house hears it. What is that digging? I began to think of Edgar Allan Poe or Gabriel Garcia Marquez as I read you here. Is there some horror buried underground in the subconscious? What's going on there?
Tom, this is very common. Every one of us hears funny scrapes or diggings or sounds in a sleepless night, and we all have sleepless nights. This is existential dread. It's not political dread.
Is it? I don't know, is the sound of digging a little louder when you're living on disputed territory?
Not necessarily. I have seen people having sleepless nights and tormentedly haunted by voices and by sounds everywhere, not just in Israel.
Do you feel any kinship with Poe when you have that sort of pounding, scraping from the cellar or beneath the cellar?
Yes, I do.
It is something anyone can relate to in the night, the scraping, the something that wants to come to the surface. Do you really think, is it the same specter that haunts all people from underground? Is it just existential dread, simple as that? Does it have cultural coloring?
It may have cultural coloring, but essentially it's an existential dread and it's universal. And I think there is hardly a single human being who have not heard sounds in a sleepless night.
Well, Rachel doesn't hear it right away. It's her father at first, but she's infected by it. Is dread infectious in that way?
Dread is infectious, yes, and trauma is infectious.
Are you a magical realist in this story?
Well, I think life is magically realistic. Not me, but life itself.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with Israeli novelist and journalist Amos Oz about his new collection of stories, Scenes from Village Life. He joins us today from Washington. Little village, 100 years old or more, he writes. Old and sleepy, Tel Ilan, with leafy trees and red roofs, agricultural small holdings, many of which have been transformed into shops, selling wines from boutique wineries, spicy olives, farmhouse cheeses, former fine farm buildings now small galleries with imported artworks and decorative toys from Africa, furniture from India sold to visitors. But at night underneath, there's a digging, there's a scraping, there's a sound that at least some of the residents just can't shake, in Amos Oz's new collection of stories, Scenes from Village Life. Santa Barbara, California, Farshad, you're on the air with Amos Oz.
Hi, Tom. I love the show, first-time caller. Thank you so much. I love the topic, and I unfortunately haven't read Amos Oz's literature so far, but I'm already a big fan, and I certainly will. And I come from Iran. I'm an ex-Muslim, so my point of views are not necessarily pro-Iran, obviously, as an apostate. I live in a different kind of world. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I see that human nature always goes for the underdog. And the Palestinian, from everybody's point of view, at least from most people's point of view, have been the underdog. And with the new uprising in Arab Spring, I believe that you're going to see more push towards reaching a peace and reaching a fair state. And I feel that the one-sided U.S. foreign policy toward Israel government, I would say, and as per Massad's point of view, it's not the entire Israeli population, we are going to actually lose our standing even more in the Arab world if we continue with the one-sided support.
Farshad, hang, there's a lot right there already. Hang on for a second. Amos Oz, what do you say to this perspective of our ex-Muslim Iranian-American caller?
Well, I think the United States of America ought to encourage both sides to make peace. It has to reassure both sides to make peace. Both Israelis and Palestinians will have to make tremendous sacrifices in order to reach an historical compromise. Both Israelis and Palestinians will have to sacrifice part of what they regard as their historical homeland. And both are right in regarding the same country as their historical homeland. So they both need reassurance and encouragement. This is the policy I would recommend America to take.
Farshad sees the United States currently is on a path that, as he describes it, there will leave it sort of on the wrong side of, I don't know, popular opinion or history or something here. What do you think of that?
Well, not necessarily so. I think the American policy is fairly balanced. It insists that Israel give back the occupied territories. It insists that Israel stops the settlement project. It insists that Israel compromises over the future of Jerusalem. And at the same time, it doesn't support the extremist Arab claim over every inch of Israel and the extremist Arab intention to wipe Israel off. So it's a fairly balanced policy. I don't think the American policy is one-sided.
Farshad?
Well, I with all due respect, I do not necessarily agree. I feel that every UN resolution has been vetoed by the U.S. That has been trying to condemn Israel for one thing or another, and the fact that Israel has had nuclear arsenal for a long time, and there has been no standing. I understand the concerns from a small Jewish state in midst of hostile environment. I understand the concerns, obviously. But the U.S. policies have definitely, from my perspective at least, not been balanced or has been unilaterally towards pro-Israel as far as I can see, and I'm very much against any movement that involves violence. I'm a very big pacifist, and I feel that at this point in history, the Palestinians have been getting the raw end of this whole ordeal for a while.
Amos Oz, let us pick it up right there. I appreciate your call from Santa Barbara. Amos?
Well, if you look at Israel and Palestine, the Palestinians are clearly the underdog. But if you look at Israel facing a challenge from the entire Arab and Muslim world, then it's no longer that clear who is the underdog. Then let us not forget, when Mr. Farshad mentions the United Nations, that the Arabs enjoy the automatic support of 80% of the UN because the Third World is unanimously and one-sidedly behind the Arabs and behind the Palestinians. So it's not so black and white.
the third world is a big piece of the world these days.
Yes.
Farshad, thank you for your call. Mark in Boston, you're on the air with Amos Oz.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Amos talks about the occupation being the cause of corruption in Israel or Israeli politics. I assume he means corruption of fundamental human and mainly Jewish values. But I ask the question, is there maybe more fundamental reasons that go pre-occupation in terms of the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, the leveling of many villages, and current events in Israel, the displacement of the Bedouin Israeli citizens in the Negev, I think about 30,000 recently off their historic lands, the destruction of Israeli citizens' homes in towns like Lod, Palestinian Israelis, you know, because their houses were built on, didn't have the proper permits, and their houses were leveled, and they were left living in tents. And I'm just, you know, I just ask this type of history that maybe raises a question of a level of compromise of values, of corruption that goes beyond the occupation.
Mark, let us pick it up. Amos Oz, you've spoken often and for years of occupation leading to corruption. Mark looks even further. What do you say?
Well, I say the issue of the Palestinian refugees who have been living for 60 years in dehumanizing conditions in refugee camps, this problem has to be resolved in the future state of Palestine. Every single Palestinian refugee deserves to have a home, a job, and a nationality, regardless to the question of which party takes how much of the blame for the plight of those refugees. And I think the plight divides, the blame divides between Israelis and Palestinians. I think the blame is partly with the Arab world who tried to destroy and annihilate Israel the day it was born in 1948. And they take a serious part in the plight and tragedy of the Palestinians. But this is irrelevant. Who caused the tragedy? The tragedy has to be solved and cured in the future state of Palestine. If all those Palestinian refugees go into Israel proper, there will be two Palestinian states and no Israel. So they have to be resettled with aid from the whole world and from the rich Arab countries and from Israel. They have to be resettled in the future state of Palestine.
Mark, I appreciate your call. Amos Oz, I wish you'd read once more for us, at least if we have time here. I think we do. You've got your Pesach and his Arab border, Adele. And there's an interesting back and forth where they're talking about happiness and unhappiness and who's caused what and where it all comes from. And I wish you'd read a bit again for us, if you'd be so kind.
One morning, while Adele was doing the ironing in Rachel's bedroom, the old man suddenly pounced on him with his head thrust forward like a charging bull and began to interrogate him. "So you're a student, eh? What sort of student are you, then?" "I'm an art student." "Art, huh? What art exactly? The art of talking nonsense? The art of deception? The dark arts?" "And if you are indeed an art student, then tell me this, if you don't mind. What are you doing here? Why aren't you at the university?" "I'm taking a break from university. I'm trying to write a book about you. About us. About you and about us. A comparison. A comparison. What sort of a comparison? A comparison to show that we are the robbers and you are the robbed? To reveal our ugly face?" "Not ugly, exactly. More like unhappy." "And how about your face? Isn't it unhappy? Are you so pretty, beyond reproach, saintly and pure?" "We are unhappy too." "So there is no difference between us. If that's the case, why are you sitting here writing a comparison?" "There are some differences." "Like what, for example?" Adele skillfully folded the blouse he was ironing, carefully laid it on the bed, placed another on the ironing board and sprinkled some water on it from a bottle before starting to iron. "Our unhappiness is partly our fault and partly your fault. But your unhappiness comes from the soul." "Our soul?" "Or from your heart. It's hard to know. It comes from you, from inside, the unhappiness. It comes from deep inside you."
Amos Oz, reading from the story Digging in his new collection of connected stories, Scenes from Village Life. Amos, I beg you to unpack this a little bit. I know you're the artist. You're the artist, and the art speaks for itself. But here you've got your young Arab talking to the old member of the Knesset, saying that we Arabs are unhappy. We're both unhappy, but your unhappiness is different. And he says, your unhappiness. And he's talking here to his Jewish landlord, for the moment anyway, comes from your soul or from your heart. What is this? Is this an Arab perspective? Is it an Amos Oz perspective? Help us.
Well, I don't necessarily stand behind Adele or Pesach in this debate between them about happiness and unhappiness.
Yes.
I have my own opinions. But I think, obviously, the Jews who live in Israel have brought with them millennia of unhappiness. They were victims of persecution, oppression, and ultimately of a mass murder on an unprecedented scale in Europe. The Arabs are also unhappy. In fact, both Jews and Arabs in two different ways are victims of Europe. The Arabs through colonialism, imperialism, oppression, and exploitation. The Jews through persecution, oppression, mass murder. Now, you would have thought that two victims of the same oppressor unite and march together to the barricades, hugging one another like long-lost brothers. Mm. Not so. In real life, some of the worst conflicts are precisely between two victims of the same oppressor. Two children of the same cruel, violent parent don't love each other. They look at each other and see the image of the cruel parent in the face of the other, of the sibling. And this is very much the case between Israelis and Arabs. They look at us and see Israel as an extension of the white, sophisticated, oppressing Europe, not as fellow victims. We look at them and we see a bunch of pogrom makers and Nazis who are in the business of cutting Jewish throats for fun. So both Jews and Arabs look at each other and see the stereotypical image of oppressing Europe. Europe bears a heavy historical responsibility for the tragedy in the Middle East.
What's the psychological key to unlocking that mutual fear in history then, to open a way?
Well, first make peace, then unlock the fears. It's very sentimentalist to assume that you can undo the fears and the lack of trust before you make peace. First, make peace with clenched teeth. Sign a contract, a document, a piece of paper between enemies.
Mm.
And then start working on a gradual emotional de-escalation.
Daniel in Montreal, Canada, you're on the air with Amos Oz.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate the discussion. I would like to comment on that digging sound you were speaking of, and it's been described so far as anxiety. I don't believe that's the sum of it. I think that the situation in Israel is very much like that described in the novels of William Faulkner. Faulkner spoke as slavery and its aftermath as the primordial sin beneath the existence of the United States. I believe the mass expulsion of 80% of the Palestinian population in 1947, the destruction of 450 villages and Palestinian towns, the continued refusal to come to terms with that legacy, is the guilt that is being heard in that digging down below the structure of Israel.
Daniel, let us pick it up right there with Amos Oz. Amos?
Yes. Well, I don't believe in an original sin. I think in 1947, hundreds of thousands of Arabs were uprooted by the Israelis because there was a massive attack from the Arab world and from the Palestinians aiming at murdering Israel the day it was born. So if there is an original sin, it is divided between the two parties. It's not necessarily an Israeli original sin, not Israel alone. However, digging is not about this. Digging is not about Israelis and Palestinians. Digging, the story and the novel, Scenes from Village Life, is essentially about the human dread and the human unhappiness, about the great and simple things in the lives of every human being. Those people in the book, in Scenes from a Village Life, they are in search for something that they have hid from themselves. It's a book about half knowing, half remembering, sometimes about half touching. It's not a book about Israelis and Palestinians. I cannot, of course, tell my readers how to read the book, but I think to read it as an allegory on Israelis and Palestinians will be a waste of a reading.
Daniel in Montreal looks to Faulkner in the South, and of course he writes of his place and culture and its own trials and tensions. What's it meant to you in this great, celebrated career now as novelist and more to have your feet planted in Israel as the ground of your literary view on the world. You could pick up universal themes, but whether it's Chekhov or Poe or Marquez, Garcia Marquez, the place matters, doesn't it? What's it meant to you to be of Israel in that literary pursuit?
Almost all my favorite writers, my mentors, were provincial writers who wrote about small-time people in small places, in villages or small towns. Chekhov, Garcia Marquez, Sherwood Anderson, William Faulkner, and many others. I strongly believe that a novel, the more provincial it is, the more universal it may become. The more local it is, the more universal it may become. Even the more parochial it is, the more universal it may become. This is in the nature of good literature everywhere. It tells the story of small-time people in a small place, in a remote place, and somehow it hits a chord of solidarity in the hearts of many, many readers.
You've been translated into 30 languages, read all
41,
over the world.
41
okay,
languages.
41. Who are your best readers, Amos Oz? Who gets you?
Unhappy readers. They are my best readers.
Wherever they may be, is there a nationality?
Wherever they may be.
No special nationality pinned to that?
No.
Are you understood better at home in Israel or abroad?
I am understood differently at different countries. You know, the Israelis are not like the Americans. The Americans read a novel to enjoy it. The Israelis read a novel in order to get worked up. They read to disagree. They read to differ. But nonetheless, people read me in Israel in great numbers, and people read me in 40 other countries. And I've been very privileged. I'm a very grateful man.
We're grateful to you for your time today and for all your work. And this wonderful new book, Scenes from Village Life. Amos Oz, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. You can continue this conversation at the On Point website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us at On Point Radio on Facebook. You can be the first to find out tomorrow's topics and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there and you'll get alerts on upcoming shows right in your newsfeed. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.